Weir. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us this evening Dr. Russell Blaylock from Jackson, Mississippi. And Dr. Blaylock is a retired neurosurgeon I've known for, 20 or more years. But right now, of course, he's lectures on things having to do with health, a wonderful source of information on so many items. And we'd really planned to talk tonight about vaccinations, about nutrition, but Russell, of course, living in Jackson, his family was involved down in New Orleans, and we thought maybe we'd let him talk a little bit about what he knows about what has actually transpired in Mississippi and their adjacent state, Louisiana, there in New Orleans. So, Russell, with that as a background, thanks so much for being with us tonight, and I'm so glad that you're safe.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. I appreciate it.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, we, of course, had the worst natural disaster that has occurred in the United States, but a much larger disaster is occurring in the failure of government at all levels to deal with this disaster. In fact, much of the disaster was created by the failure of government on a local level. And I would put, of course, the primary blame would be on the mayor of New Orleans and the governor of Louisiana. That's where the initial disaster was created. I attended medical school in New Orleans and lived there for 4 years, met my wife there. She lived there all her life. So know New Orleans pretty well. And for years, this was over 30 years ago, I was in medical school, and for years they discussed this disaster as happening if a hurricane ever hit New Orleans. In 1969, we had Camille hit the Gulf Coast and just missed New Orleans. And at the time, it was discussed that if Camille had hit New Orleans as a direct hit, of course, the flood surge would have drowned New Orleans. It just created another Lake Pontchartrain over New Orleans and killed millions of people if they hadn't been evacuated. So Camille was a sort of a wake-up call, and all of these studies were being produced by the Corps of Engineers and other groups. LSU Hurricane Center was putting out reports, and they all said the same thing. If we don't create a system to protect New Orleans through its levee system and some other ideas which are even better, that we're going to lose New Orleans. And hundreds of thousands of people could lose their lives, millions would be displaced, and New Orleans would be uninhabitable. And that's what was eventually to take place 30 years later. Despite all of these studies, despite the money being available, nothing was essentially done. One of the most sensible ideas was that there's an inlet that allows Lake Pontchartrain to rise and fall. And there was an idea to plug the outlet during hurricane season to prevent that water from flowing over the levees. But that was overridden by the environmentalists and the fishermen who didn't want to endanger the environment, endanger the fishing industry.
Hold that thought there for just a minute. We'll be right back in a moment with Dr. Russell Blaylock talking about the tragedy of Katrina. Go right ahead, Russell.
Basically, we had this inexpensive idea of controlling the level of Lake Pontchartrain, which would be the major source of water endangering New Orleans. but this was overridden because the environmentalists objected and the fishermen objected. But of course now we see the environmentalist damage is enormous, and the loss of the fishing industries will be in the billions of dollars. Many of these fishermen that objected to this simple plan now are completely bankrupt. They'll never have their businesses back. So it was through this inaction. Now, the mayors of New Orleans, which is a series of mayors and city councils, were known for their corruption. They stole the tax money. They did all sorts of terrible things to the city of New Orleans, totally ignoring this danger to the city. So they all shared the blame. But the latest mayor, of course, was the captain of the ship. We had plenty of warning of the power of this hurricane, that it was approaching New Orleans dead center. Yet, while he ordered the evacuation of New Orleans, and most of the people who had a way out left, he had over 2,000 buses which he could have bused. At least the people who were elderly and infirm, people who were in wheelchairs, people who were the pregnant women, the small children, at the least he could have evacuated them, but he didn't. He left them in the city. They wanted to, a lot of them wanted out of the city. Some didn't, but a lot did. And, you know, so these buses ended up underwater. And by the time the enormity of this crisis occurred, it was too late. The buses were useless. The people were stranded. So his idea was, well, we'll put them all in the Superdome. And some went to the convention center, some 12,000, 15,000. And we had this absolute disaster in both these areas. There was no security. There was no plan for anything approaching security for the hospital, some of the most vulnerable places. Charity Hospital is a huge hospital. It's over 2,000-bed hospital. They should have immediately had the police guard all the hospitals because they knew these looters and these gangs were going to come in and do what they did. New Orleans is notorious for its violent gangs. So they knew these gangs were well-armed, that they were not going to leave the city.
Hold up, thoughts for just a minute, Russell. We're going to bring our other stations back to our network right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dr. Russell Blaylock, who lives in Jackson, Mississippi, went to school there in New Orleans, and knows the city very well. And, of course, he commented that there were plenty of buses that the mayor, after he asked for the evacuation of the city, should have provided the buses, up to 3,000 buses. They could have gotten most of the people out who wanted to leave, no difficulty at all. But instead of doing what was logical and helping the people who were incapable of leaving because of infirmity or because they just didn't have any place to go or felt lost or didn't have any means of transportation, didn't have enough money for their gasoline, for their cars, why, of course, he didn't do anything. And then, of course, when the flood came, why the buses were actually buried under a deluge of water and became useless. But there was no arrangement made to guard the major hospitals there. And he was talking about the major hospital there with 2,000 beds. But there was no guards there because apparently there had been lots of looting, pardon me, at least the potential for looting, the violent gangs in the city. Everybody knew they were there. But no efforts were made to have the guards around the hospitals where there were people who were really so vulnerable. So pick up the story there, Russell.
Yeah, and the police were waiting, you know, the average policeman, they were waiting for instructions from their commander. Well, the commander had no communication system. There had been no previous plan to say, okay, this is what we do when communications is lost. This group is to go and protect Charity Hospital. This group is to protect Tulane and the other hospitals in the city, which were vital. They were filled with sick and infirm and dying people. The generators in Charity Hospital were in the basement, so they were immediately flooded. All power was lost in the hospital. All of this emergency planning over the years and years and years, why didn't they put the generators in the upper floors of the hospital so they'd be protected? They didn't do that. So they immediately lost power. Well, you had intensive care units filled with patients that were on respirators. And so once the power's gone, then you have to do what we call bagging. There's a little bag you squeeze to keep the patient ventilated. You can only do that for so long. I can remember I did it one time for 30 minutes, and it was just the most tiring, exhausting thing in the world. So they had to rotate, and of course, eventually, people were so fatigued, because you realize they didn't sleep for 6 days, that some of the patients died. They began to use the morgue, had an artificial morgue between, I think, the 11th and 12th floor of Charity, because the basement where the morgue is normally, housed was completely flooded. So the doctors ended up having to barricade themselves because the gangs invaded the hospital looking for drugs. The doctors barricaded themselves behind, barricaded walls to protect themselves from the gangs. There were no police in sight. There were no National Guardsmen. Now, at this time, this was within the first few days of the emergency. The governor of Louisiana had activated the National Guard and put them on standby. They were not entering the city. They were not protecting the hospitals, the people. They were just on standby in the outskirts of New Orleans.
No, why would you do that? I mean, your National Guard's supposed to be there helping and certainly protecting the infrastructure of the society. Why have them standing around outside when the violence is going on and inside the city?
Well, these are things that's going to have to come out in an investigation, because her whole activity during this entire crisis was characterized by inactivity. They increased the guard from 7,000 to 10,000. Still, they were not entering the city. The gangs were starting to shoot at any of the National Guard helicopters that tried to fly in and rescue people. One of the guardsmen was shot in one of the helicopters, and so they had to call off even the meager rescue that they were trying to carry out. These guardsmen were very brave, but they couldn't risk losing the helicopters and crashing into the crowds and killing people by these snipers shooting them. And I don't know if you saw some of the footage, but they showed the policemen trapped with fully automatic gunfire. And so the government came out later and said, well, this wasn't really gunfire. These were cars backfiring. Well, there were no cars. The place was flooded. There weren't a lot of traffic on the streets. So that was sheer nonsense. And if you watch the footage, and anybody who's ever heard gunfire, you know that it's guns. The policemen were pinned down. And in the Superdome, it was just total anarchy. They interviewed one of the residents, who was a neurosurgery resident, who had volunteered to try to help out. And his report, and I heard his report directly, he said it was just total anarchy, that they had six rapes the first day, six rapes or seven rapes the second day, and 3 to 4 murders every day. Then the news media came back later and said, well, the official explanation, this wasn't true, that this was just rumor. Well, this doctor treated the rape victims. He took care of the dead bodies of those who were killed, so he knew that it was happening. He was the number one witness, and he refused to go back. He said, I'm leaving, and I'm not coming back until there's security in the Superdome.
But then why did they move the National Guard troops into the... I mean, I know it's a rhetorical question because we don't have the answers, but it is totally illogical that the police weren't there, that the National Guard wasn't there, when you've got all of this violence taking place.
Exactly. I mean, there should have been a massive National Guard presence inside the Superdome. Well, they denied all this death was taking place, and then when they finally evacuated the Superdome, they found 17 dead bodies in the restroom. They had one suicide in the Superdome. They had all of these rape victims, and now we find out they were raping children, that they had kidnapped a young boy, age 7, raped him, and cut his throat. And they had a little girl that was gang raped and died. So, you know, we have these horrific things taking place because it was the police officers there were spread all over the city trying to hold things together, but they had no leadership. They were staying up 24 hours a day for 6 solid days, outnumbered by the gangs and outnumbered by the thugs and hooligans. And no relief from the National Guard until, I think, the fourth day. as when the National Guard began to infiltrate in rather large numbers. And then Bush ordered the 82nd Airborne to come in. And then suddenly you begin to see things getting better. But even then, on the sixth day, there were still sniper attacks. And that's when the New Orleans policemen who were escorting some engineers through the streets of New Orleans were attacked by snipers, and they returned fire and killed two of them, and I think seriously injured a couple more. But it shows the level of degeneration of this city, the total lack of planning. The mayor was a complete failure. He was responsible for this mess. He was portrayed as a hero on CNN, as if he was just concerned about his city and working so hard. He left New Orleans and went to Baton Rouge, staying in a plush hotel. He didn't even stay in his city to help the people. So you saw Giuliani going through the city and the dangerous rubble and all of these things. Well, none of that was present in New Orleans by this mayor. He flew immediately to Baton Rouge. Of course, he claimed that, well, I was on the phone trying to get FEMA to do things, and I was on trying to get the governor to do things. But the disaster was his fault because he didn't take these people out of the city. And when they showed the video, you saw pregnant women who were just on the point of delivering their babies. There were several babies born on the overpasses. They were born in the Superdome. Little small children that were dying from the heat. Why weren't these people evacuated? I mean, these were the most vulnerable people in wheelchairs all over the place. Well, one of the worst things was in the convention center, where they had some 12,000-15,000 people housed. The gangs were in there, and they were murdering people. And yesterday they showed some of the pictures of a man that was murdered, and his body was mutilated after he was killed. And they said there were also pictures of people who were murdered in their wheelchairs, and their bodies were so horribly mutilated after they were dead that they couldn't show them on television. So we're having these horrible acts of brutality, and these people had no protection from anyone. And this is all in the lap of the mayor, and it's in the lap of the governor of Louisiana. These people, you know, you think the executives of Enron went to jail for 20 years for malfeasance funds. These people are responsible for the death of hundreds of people, possibly thousands, the total destruction of this city. The governor should go to prison, and the mayor of New Orleans certainly should go to prison for what he's done. But, of course, we're not going to see any of that.
Well, it's a terrible tragedy, and of course, fortunately, a lot of the people did get out the city, but now they don't have any place to go back to. It sounds like so many of the homes there have been lost. The water is certainly destroying the very foundation of so many of the homes. Were the parts of the city where there wasn't a little water, where people really were safe, in some of the better districts? Was the violence primarily in the in the areas where the poor people lived? Were there areas there that really were safe and where people were living and functioning pretty well if they had adequate water and food?
Well, most of the people that were undergoing these really harsh conditions were in Orleans Parish, which is mainly downtown New Orleans. Out in Jefferson Parish, which is to the west of this, it had a variable. Some of it was up to the rooftops, and when you saw these pictures up to the rooftops of the houses, a lot of that was in Jefferson Parish. Other parts of Jefferson Parish, further west and north of the interstate, some of those were minor damage, and then you get out into Kenner, they were almost all right, completely just had some trees down. But the difference was, in Jefferson Parish, the Sheriff Harry Lee immediately put out an order to shoot and kill all looters who are looting anything other than food and water.
Hold that stuff right there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, I guess, this evening, Dr. Russell Blaylock. And apparently in one area where the sheriff had put out an order that they were to shoot anybody for looting, unless, of course, they were trying to get food or water. And I think that this is understandable, people going into the stores for food and water. But, you know, when they're taking certainly television sets and all the other things that we saw some examples of, why this is totally unconscionable. So pick up the story there, Russell.
Yeah, the, Sheriff Harry Lee is an excellent sheriff, and he's the sheriff of Jefferson Parish. So immediately he put out an order, any looter, you know, other than for water and food or medicine, they're to be shot and killed on sight. And so it stopped all of it immediately. It was just no problem in Jefferson Parish.
Now, for those of us who don't know, because I don't know New Orleans, is Jefferson Parish is this a separate part? Is it like a county, or is it a separate part of the city?
Well, it's a separate part. It's what's called Metairie, which is just to the west of New Orleans proper.
All right.
But it's a lot of subdivisions. It's huge subdivisions and your businesses, and they have beef. East Jefferson Hospital there. He immediately organized things. Now, FEMA came in. This shows how the federal government operates. FEMA came in to Jefferson Parish. Walmart had bought in a huge 18-wheeler packed with water that they were donating. FEMA official came in and turned them back and said, we don't need any water. Then the Coast Guard came in with a huge supply of diesel fuel, and FEMA turned them away, said, we don't need any diesel fuel either. If that wasn't bad enough, then they disconnected the communication lines so that they couldn't carry out communications in Jefferson Parish. Harry Lee was, the sheriff was so outraged, he took his deputies, he reconnected the communication lines, put his deputies there, armed to keep the FEMA officials away. In other words, he was willing to shoot them to protect his communication line. And that's the only thing that kept things going in Jefferson Parish.
So what the FEMA people did was they came in and they just overrode everybody else and created chaos.
It endangered everybody. I mean, they were cutting off communication. People were desperate for water. They cut off the water. You saw all the people on the rooftops. A lot of that was in Jefferson Parish. These people were dying of thirst. In New Orleans, you know, it's 95 degrees and 110% humidity. It's stifling heat. You can't survive on those roofs very long without water. A lot of these people had to be hacked out of their attics. They were in desperate situation. And here's the FEMA cutting off their water.
Well, we've heard the stories about the people wanted to come in, say, from Florida with their airboats, you know, with the big propellers on the back, and they were turned away, and the flotillas of boats from other parts of Louisiana with outboard motors wanted to come in and help with the rescue, and they were turned away, too. And so it seems like all we really had was, at least initially, was the helicopters getting people off the roofs.
Exactly. They had one gentleman came from, I think, Alabama. He brought seven airboats with him and presented himself to the FEMA officials and said, I bought these airboats. I bought my own fuel. Where do I need to go? And they said, well, we're going to take the airboats. And they locked them up and wouldn't let him use them. Now, in South Louisiana, the Cajun community, they live in swamps. They have thousands, tens of thousands of boats of every kind. And every time there's been a hurricane, they always bring their boats and rescue everybody.
Hold that thought right here. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Russell Blaylock. And he's telling about what had happened there. Of course, here you have people coming in. The Florida people, I don't think, ever got there. They were just told, don't bother to come with your airboats. You're not going to get in. But Russell was just saying that the Cajun community, certainly it lives in boats. They live in the swamps. So what happened there, Russell?
Well, usually, when there's a hurricane, they just volunteer and bring in all the boats and rescue people. They wouldn't let them in. A lot of them were not allowed to enter. They could have easily rescued these people on rooftops, just fan out all over, the city and pick people off the rooftops, rather than having to do it helicopter, person at a time. So it could have been done much quicker. There's no telling how many people are dead inside of their attics that died long ago. All that's going to have to be discovered by chopping these attics open to see who's in there. It could be hundreds, could be thousands, who knows. But all those people could have been saved if they'd have just said and told all the people in the Cajun communities, please come help, bring your boats, help us search rooftops and attics and bring out as many people as you can. And they would have done it in a flash. We saw this interfere with. Now, Trent Lott, our senator here, he lost his home in Biloxi, and he had nothing good to say about FEMA. He said the FEMA people rolled in to his community, Pascagoula, and said, we're going to set up a shop here and set a central command, and people can come here and get food and water. And he was just outraged. He said, these people can't come and get food and water. They're destitute. They're miles from here. You're going to have to go out and find them. And he said, you need local people to help you find these people and bring the food and water to them. He said, that's just how idiotic this whole operation was carried out. And when they interviewed many of the people in Biloxi and Gulfport and Waveland and these cities that were destroyed, they haven't seen hide nor hair of a FEMA official. A lot of them have never seen a Red Cross official. It was just, they were on their own. Well, a lot of volunteers went in there and took care of feeding them and bringing them water. The situation in New Orleans, my son just got back from New Orleans. He lives in Jefferson Parish in Metairie, and he went to check on his house, and of course it was flooded. It's just absolute devastation. We've got some excellent pictures of all the destruction that's gone on and things you see on the news media.
Was he able to get into the city at all?
Yeah, in Jefferson Parish, they allowed the homeowners to go in and check their homes and see what they could salvage. He lost his house. He's lost his job because the job where he worked in New Orleans was destroyed. And so his boss said, we don't have a business anymore. So, he's living with us. He's looking for a new job. And this is the story of a million people from the Gulf Coast and from New Orleans. They're fanned out all over the United States looking for jobs, trying to start their lives from scratch. They can't get information. It took us 5 days to find out what happened to my wife's mother and father and her sister. They were in Covington, which is just north of Lake Pontchartrain, and the hurricane passed right through there. It knocked out all electricity, all the communications for half of Mississippi. So I was in Orlando, Florida, giving a talk. I couldn't call home. I couldn't talk to my sons. We had no idea where her mother or father or sister were, or their condition, whether their house was destroyed. We called Red Cross. We called FEMA. We called every government agency. They were unable to find out anything for us. So it was just an information blackout for 5 days. And on the sixth day, her mother was finally able to get through and contact us. The good example here is this. We had this huge disaster. It was half of Mississippi and one of the largest cities in Louisiana. And our Homeland Security, FEMA, all this planning was absolutely paralyzed. It shows that if there was a huge terrorist attack, our government would be absolutely worthless.
And of course, what we need is local community, local control, and certainly a National Guard that's protecting America, not halfway around the world, bringing democracy to Iraq, that where most people there really don't want democracy. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Russell Blaylock, and we'll be exploring this question a little bit more. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Russell, and our guest this evening, Dr. Russell Blaylock. Well, Russell, you know, what's the lesson to be learned about from this?
Well, the basic lesson is if you want to survive a disaster, you have to prepare yourself, and you have to have a mindset that you're on your own, and you're with your neighbors, and you're going to have to protect yourself. Almost all the lives saved were private initiatives. Citizens getting together, bringing water, bringing food, bringing health care, providing homes to take care of these people. It's not a massive government relief that saved lives. So you have to prepare ahead of time. You can't act like the governor of Louisiana or the mayor of New Orleans. You have to realize we're living in a dangerous world. Terrible things can suddenly happen. You have to have your home stocked with food and water and medical supplies to take care of yourself and your neighbors. It's just a fool's idea that you're going to be protected by your government, because this disaster has demonstrated the failure of government at every level to protect people.
Now, one of the things that really disturbs me is that we're hearing that they're moving in there with the military, and they're taking the guns away from the law-abiding citizens. You know, if they were disarming the snipers and the gangs, that would be one thing, but why take the guns away from law-abiding citizens who need guns to protect themselves from the murderers and rapists?
Well, absolutely, and of course this is always the response they have. Well, it's easy to take it away from a responsible citizen, but it's dangerous to take it away from a gang member, so they go to the easy segment. Well, let's get all the guns away from the decent citizens who are trying to protect their property and their lives against these thugs. 400 police officers walked off the job and just disappeared in New Orleans. The rest of the police that stayed and sacrificed, they didn't have the leadership. They were outmanned and outgunned by these gangs. And so, it depended on the citizenry that was well armed. If these people had not been armed, there's no telling what these gangs would have done. I mean, they're raping children. They're killing and mutilating bodies of elderly people in wheelchairs, helpless people. I mean, this is the kind of animal that was operating in these cities. Unless the populace is armed during these disasters, you're not going to be able to protect yourself and your family. And, we should be outraged that this was going on. One of the other things that appeared, it didn't make the news, but
hold that thought right there for Russell as we bring our other stations up. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this evening. Dr. Russell Blaylock, we're talking about what happened in New Orleans, where then the military moves in. And they began taking the guns away, not from the gang members, not from the rapists and the murderers. They take them away from the law-abiding citizens who need weapons to protect themselves from the rapists and the murderers. And so what in heaven's name would be the reason to take the weapons away from people who need them? Because once, of course, the military and the police left, why these people would be totally defenseless. There's one thing that these murderers fear, and that is people who are going to shoot back at them. And of course, what can you expect in a country that's taken God out of our schools, where the Supreme Court has said, why, we couldn't post the Ten Commandments in a school because, if we had that Ten Commandments there, why, the children might read them. And if they read them, they might meditate upon them. If they meditated upon them, they might obey them, and that would be a violation of the wall of separation between church and state. That's what our United States Supreme Court said. So should we be surprised that we have lawlessness in a nation that's rejected God's law? Pick up the story there, Russell.
Well, one of the other things that people need to know is these gangs were going through the city and they'd robbed stores, and when they were finished, they'd burn the store to the ground. They burned an entire shopping center in New Orleans. They burned Saks Fifth Avenue. And they were going in private homes. They went into the better homes in New Orleans, were robbing the homes, and then burning the houses to the ground. So here's New Orleans, devastated by a flood, devastated by the hurricane, and you have these gang thugs going through the city, burning the economic base of the city to the ground. so that the city couldn't survive at all. You know, one of the other things, they had these gangs went into a nursing home and was robbing the people in the nursing home, and they tried to break into a children's hospital to rob it. I mean, this is the level of the monster that was operating inside of New Orleans, and we didn't have the government protecting the people. As you say, they were disarming people. If I look at this whole thing together, this is the statement I'd have to make. It had the appearance of planned destruction. It was as if FEMA was trying to make this disaster much worse than it was. You know, as bad as it was, as horrible as it was, they were trying to make it worse by denying water, denying food, by denying the guardsmen entry into the city, by disarming citizens, by allowing these sites like the Superdome and the Convention Center to be sites where murder and rape was being carried on every day. It was as if all this was planned, so it would be a total disaster and destroy these people's lives and make it where New Orleans couldn't come back, because they were burning all of these stores and homes, and they're still burning stores and homes. They even burned one of the oil storage depots there that was everybody saw on the television. I mean, this was a gang of terrorists, and a lot of the troopers said, they had just gotten back from Iraq, and said, we didn't see things like this in Iraq. In fact, they had testimony from one of the National Guardsmen about the children being raped and murdered, and said, we didn't see this thing in a war zone. You know, we're seeing things in New Orleans, Louisiana, that you would expect to see in the worst of the wars, Rwanda or something. It's unbelievable. Now, one of the other things that was kept quiet was that the appearance of NATO was invited into the area. And my son has some good pictures of blue helicopters flying around. They have no markings on them. So, you know, we don't know, are these UN helicopters or this NATO helicopters? What were they there for? We don't know.
Well, I have read on the Internet that we had asked NATO to help with some of the transportation, things of that sort. So, while American troops are stationed in Japan 60 years after the end of the Second World War, because we're defending Japan against, well, we're not sure we're defending it against, but we have to have our troops there, about 50,000 of them, and another 50,000 troops in Germany 60 years after the war ended. We've got to take the National Guard, whose real purpose is to defend America, and send them over to Iraq. Why couldn't we pull the troops out of Germany and out of Japan? Why did we have to send troops out of National Guard troops out of America and leave our country defenseless? That's what's so unconscionable, and apparently a lot of the National Guard helicopters were over there, so that there was a shortage of helicopters as well. I mean, somebody is really going to have to answer to the American people. Is it more important to bring democracy to Iraq or to preserve our republic here in the United States?
Well, you're exactly right. You know, I agree with your assessment. The purpose of the National Guard, the primary purpose, is to protect the states. It's not to fight foreign wars. You know, that's what the regular army and the Marines and the Navy is supposed to do. And like you say, we have them spread out all over the world. Most of them are not protecting against a huge Soviet invasion, as we were told for all these years. So if you're going to have a war in Iraq, why aren't you using regular troops? Why are you taking people from their jobs and from the protection of the states? So that when a disaster like this happens, you know, you're scrambling to bring these National Guardsmen in.
Well, I really feel it really is that one of the greatest tragedies I've seen in my lifetime. You know, we're talking pretty close to a million refugees here in America, and people whose lives are shattered, and somehow the government's going to give them all a $2,000 debit card, as if somehow that's going to solve the problem.
Right, it's just a little patchwork here and it's all for appearance. It's not to take care of problems. I mean, we have people in hotels here. There's in two rooms, there's 28 people. People are buying homes sight unseen just to have a place to live. Most of these people are saying they're not going back. They're not going to return. Wherever they ended up as these refugees, they're staying. They're just going to build their lives wherever they're staying. So this is the desperation of these people. This is the anger of these people about how poorly this disaster was handled. They don't want to go back to New Orleans. They're going to start their lives over in new communities. And you realize what a terrible, depressing thing it is to have your life ripped away. I mean, my son, here he has a little baby. He's got a four-year-old. His four-year-old was just enrolled in school. He has a good job, and suddenly he has nothing. And he's living with us and, you know, trying to figure out what he's going to do with his life. His job disappeared. So, you know, and this story is multiplied a million times, and some people are a lot worse than him. They've lost family members. They're seriously injured, or all sorts of disasters have happened.
Well, now, what about the southern part of Mississippi down there along the coast? Certainly, they had terrible devastation there, but has there been a sense of lawlessness? Has there been gangs there at all, or marauders there? Have the people there, of course, been able to hang together and maintain a system of law and order despite the terrible destruction?
Well, in the beginning, they had some looting, but the governor ordered a shoot-to-kill order as well, and it stopped very quickly. But most of the people organized themselves, and of course in Mississippi people have guns and they know how to use them, and these thugs know that they'll use them, so they protected their property and their family and their neighbors and friends, and you know, help poured in. Most of the people that had arms went to help these people out, but the outpouring of help from the state of Mississippi has just been unbelievable. The generosity of people is heartwarming. I mean, it brings tears to the eyes to see the sacrifice that these people have made to help out their fellow Mississippians. But, you know, a dozen cities were destroyed on the Gulf Coast. Waveland was completely destroyed. It doesn't even exist anymore. Biloxi, 80% of the city was destroyed. Slidell, most of it was destroyed. So you have these very large communities, and these people have nothing left. It's just totally disrupted their lives.
Well, these people, most of them would have hurricane insurance. I mean, do they offer hurricane insurance to people down in that area?
Yeah, some do, but you know, there's a fair number of people that are lower middle income, and a lot of them didn't have insurance. And these are people who've lived there for generations. You know, most of these aren't newly arrived people. They've lived there for generations, and they love these areas. And Biloxi is a beautiful city. You know, always, as a child, I used to love, my dad would take me to Biloxi because it was so pretty. Had beautiful homes. Well, all those homes are gone. It had one of the most beautiful drives. Jefferson Davis' home was there. It survived Camille, but there's no evidence that it ever existed now. It's just been the worst devastation that I ever remember. We always compared everything to Camille. But Camille was a lightweight compared to what this has done.
Well, now, did the National Guard, the Mississippi National Guard, get down there? And were they needed at all? What about the local sheriff? What about the local police? Were they able to maintain the law and order, you know, with the help of the people?
Well, because the cities were so absolutely destroyed, the police were just in disarray. And most of them lost their homes. Many of them lost their families. You know, the death rate, the death toll was, I think, 146. All communications, everything was destroyed. So, a lot of the police departments just organized on their own. And they did a very good job. They brought things together, brought some semblance of law and order. The firemen got together and you know, they, even though their families needed them, they were right there on the scene. Many of them wouldn't leave. They wanted to take care of the people. You know, it's just some really heartwarming stories of the sacrifice that these people have made to protect their neighbors and their communities, which have nothing to do with government. It's just private initiative.
Well, you know, Russell, we got an awful lot of great people, of wonderful people here in America. We're still the greatest people in the world, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, one gentleman, he had a restaurant, and he drove down to Biloxi and set up a tent and cooked meals for 1,000 people, ran out of food, went back, got more food, and bought it back all at his own expense. And you know, he wasn't a big restaurateur, he was just a small operation, but he felt the call, and so, you know, he went out there and fed the people. Well, where was the Red Cross? Where was FEMA? They were nowhere in sight. Most of these people say they haven't seen any representative from Red Cross or...
How about Salvation Army? Did they get that?
Salvation Army's done very good. Most of your churches, you know, the churches here in Mississippi are very strong, very deeply Christian. And they've poured in just tons of food and blankets and everything people need. So that the churches and the Salvation Army and private charities and the communities have just really done everything they can to help these people.
Well, that's gratifying to know that, you know, that would happen, and certainly, but as far as you know, that the National Guard did get down there, but were they really even needed then? They were able to restore order with the local police?
Well, yeah, they helped the local police, and of course they did a lot of food distributions and about the MREs and or MRA, what is it?
MREs, right.
MRE. And the water, you know, water was one of the things that was just absolutely in short supply. All the water was contaminated, and none of the facilities worked. So, you know, the National Guard did a really commanding job. You know, they deserve high praise, both in New Orleans, once they were allowed in, and on the Gulf Coast. They really worked hard. They worked long hours. They sacrificed a lot, so the hat's off to the police officers that stayed and worked unbelievable hours, risked their own lives. The hat's off to these guys. They're the hero, and the number one hero is Sheriff Harry Lee, which the press has always hated. You know, they vilified this man forever because he always brings law and order. You know, he protects his community.
Well, I'm sure that's why he gets reelected, despite the fact that the media will vilify anybody who tries to do the job well.
Oh, he's one of the most popular people in the entire area. But that's the kind of man it takes. But eventually they'll destroy him because he is a man of great character.
Well, it certainly is an amazing, amazing story of an impossible situation. And, of course, one trouble with New Orleans, it's pretty known as a sinful city. And if you have a sinful city, should you be really surprised that such terrible things happen? There was to be the Southern Decadence conference or celebration there. Was be actually the very week. I think it was to begin on the 28th and go to the 5th. Something like that. It was go from Wednesday to the following Monday, where they were bringing in 150,000 homosexuals to celebrate decadence down there and in Bourbon Street. And well, maybe it's just coincidence that this terrible thing happened at that time, just at that very, very week.
Well, it was interesting that the film crews interviewed and showed some of the black church people down in this terrible hell that they were isolated in, and had a black woman and tears pouring down her face, and she said, "This has happened to New Orleans because it's a sinful city." She said, "It's just filled with sin, and we did nothing about it." You know, and she was just crying and praying, and all the people were singing hymnals, and I mean, it was just touching. But she made a very important point, because the big money maker in New Orleans is Bourbon Street, is the French Quarter. The city has always protected it. They've allowed anything to go on in this area. They have a strong homosexual community that's just blatant. There's drinking and pornography and, you name it, it goes on, and it's strongly connected to organized crime, always has been. When I was a medical student working in pathology, we used to get young girls that would end up in the river dead because they would be dancing in the clubs underage, and they would try to leave, and the mafia would kill them and throw them in the river. These were 15, 16-year-old girls. This sort of thing's gone on for years in New Orleans, in the French Quarter. The churches didn't oppose it. They didn't speak about it because it was such a big source of income, and it was just allowed to continue.
Well, of course, nobody wants to talk about such things, but I believe that God will not be mocked, and I believe God is sovereign. I believe God can certainly, make things happen. He can prevent them from happening, and, well, I think that this maybe ought to be a good lesson to an awful lot of people throughout America today. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess that for this first hour has been Dr. Russell Blaylock. We've got about 3 minutes, and then we'll wrap up the program, and then we'll go on to the second hour when we'll be talking about the vaccines and the very real problem we have with that. Well, Russell, we've got about a minute, two and a half minutes for you to wrap up this section of the program. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners? What do you think we should learn from what has happened this last week?
Well, the number one lesson would be that you have to prepare for your own survival, your own protection. Get together with your neighbors, stock food, stock water. Don't depend on the government, because the government's not going to be there. Be in a strong church so your church community can help protect you as well. That's a good place to store food and medical supplies and these sort of things you're going to need in this sort of emergency. But we've seen a massive failure of government at all levels, which is not surprising, because this happened in Hurricane Andrew as well. It was exactly a week before the National Guard was sent in, before food and water entered for these people in Florida. So in 1992, we had a dress rehearsal of this, and here we have it repeated. I don't think there's much hope that things will improve, even with this as another dramatic lesson.
Well, I think that maybe the lesson is don't depend on the government to look after you. Be prepared yourself, and there are lots of things that people need to have, and of course we've talked about the vitamins you ought to have on hand, elementary medicines that you need on hand, some way to have water, because if you don't have a means of sterilizing water, you could even take water out of your swimming pool or out of a stream, but you need a way to sterilize it, and there are water filters that will do that. But think ahead, make a plan, and we even have an excellent book called Inside the Red Zone, which is actually written by a man named Igor Shafid that was trained by the Soviets. He was actually trained as a communist doctor in Russia and became a Christian. But the list of things that you need to have, they're up on the Internet. Get them. Begin making your preparations. Hope that it will never affect us, but in case it does, in the final analysis, the things are going to get us through, first of all, our faith in God. But we'd be very foolish not to make our preparations to look after ourselves, to look after our family, to look after our neighbors and the people that we come in contact with. Because right now, of course, I think what we've seen there in New Orleans is the total failure of government to provide for the people. And we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent on you out there in the listening audience. If you believe that, as I do, that we're involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, if you believe that there really are dark spiritual forces that many times blind men from doing what is just, that sometimes can even perhaps encourage people to be totally lawless and ruthless and brutal and act like animals, if you believe that our country is turned against God, and if we don't have a great revival in this country, well, we're going to lose this wonderful, wonderful nation that has provided the highest standards of living ever known to any group of people throughout all time. Why, we hope many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, we'd be glad to send you one. If you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, that's 1-800-544-8927, and we have our latest newsletter. It would be called The Origin of Wars. The Origin of Wars, and of course it goes along with our other newsletter. We had the previous month, that would be the June newsletter, entitled The Occult Hierarchy, Part 2. And yes, there really is an occult hierarchy. If you have access to the Internet, you can go up on the Internet and type in the Google search, occult hierarchy. And you'll see a number of websites put up there by people who are related to this occult hierarchy, that a spiritual hierarchy that works behind the scenes, behind governments, behind the princes of this world. So if you'd like to get the free newsletter, fine. If you can go up on the website at www.radioliberty.com, that's www.radioliberty.com, where you can pull down our newsletters, and we encourage you to do that. We encourage you to go to our website and listen to our live radio programs, which we do 5 hours a day, and you can link into them either there or to link to the other websites where we're doing them. And then, of course, we archive 3 hours of programs every day, and you can listen to those. Now, that's a lot of listening time. You're not going to get very much accomplished, but our job is to try to educate you. So, and we actually have people who listen 5 hours a day because they find that the material is information they're not going to get elsewhere. And so our job is to try to get you educated. I do want to mention that we are having an annual conference, a Radio Liberty conference. It'll be held in the Santa Cruz area on November the 19th. And that's November the 19th. If you'd like to know any more, why, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's the annual Radio Liberty conference held at the Seascape Golf Course on November 19th. That's the week before Thanksgiving. So we hope that many of you out there will be able to come. And if you have other people you could bring, why, we'd appreciate that. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our website is www.radioliberty.com. So we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. Because if the American people don't turn back to God, God will never again bless this nation. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. Once to every man and nation comes the time, the moment to decide, in the strife of truth with falsehood for the good or evil side. Some great cause, some new Messiah, offering each the bloom or blight, and the choice goes on forever, twixt the darkness and the light. Then to side with truth is noble, when to share her wretched crust, ere her cause be bring fame and fortune and disprosperous, to be just. Then it is the brave man chooses, while the coward stands aside, until the multitudes make virtue of the faith they had denied. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and, well, this evening we're having with us Dr. Russell Blaylock, and Dr. Blaylock is a retired neurosurgeon who I've known for many, many years. At the present time, he spends a great deal of time researching things having to do with health, and he's written a wonderful book called Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, another book, Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills, another book called Natural Strategies for Cancer Patients, and then, of course, he has a newsletter that he puts out every month through Newsmax, which I subscribe to, and you should subscribe to it, too, because you'll find all sorts of things there that you won't find mentioned anywhere. In fact, I was just reading the latest newsletter going into Q10 and so many of the other things that really do help our energy and all the other things. But let's not talk about that specifically. I thought maybe this hour we'd talk about vaccines. And you'll always hear people say, oh, I'm in favor of vaccines, but, you know, there are certain of them that have had some problems. Well, I would like to suggest that many of the vaccines have had problems. In fact, they've come up with a new vaccine where they're going to combine measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox, all in one vaccine. Four major insults to children whose immune systems are really incomplete. And how did they experiment with this? Well, they compared children given this vaccine with children given measles, mumps, and rubella, and then their chickenpox vaccine separately. In other words, you're comparing two groups of children that, you know, are getting major insults to their body. And they say, gee, there's no difference at all, nothing to worry about. So, well, that is the background, Dr. Blaylock. Why don't you pick up and tell us why you're concerned about vaccines? After all, when we went to medical school, we were taught this was the most wonderful thing that had ever happened, that this was one of the great public health miracles of modern times, that we'd actually eliminated so many major diseases. But nobody ever mentioned the possible consequences of max vaccination. So pick up the story.
Yeah, the vaccines, what concerns me is several things. Is one, the number of vaccinations that are being given. We've increased from when my children were small, which was about 20 years ago, they were getting 15 injections, to now there's over 33 injections being given. So the number of vaccinations have increased tremendously, and they keep adding more and more to the schedule, thinking, well, we'll vaccinate against chickenpox, and we'll vaccinate against this and that. And it's just an unlimited number of vaccines they think they can give safely. But the scientific literature says otherwise. When you look at the science behind vaccination, it's a very dangerous thing to over-vaccinate. For one thing, we know that when you vaccinate someone, it not only activates their immune system in their body that we normally think of, but also in their brain. The brain has its own immune system. And when you vaccinate someone, you're powerfully activating the brain's special immune system. Normally, when that happens, say if you're sick and a virus should enter your brain, these immune cells in the brain will attack the virus, kill it, and quickly turn themselves off. And that's because in the process of killing that virus, it also damages brain connections, the synapses and dendrites, so that it has to coordinate this attack, get it over very quickly, and let things be repaired. But what happens when you vaccinate somebody with a series of vaccines...
Russell, would you please hold that for a minute, because I think this is so important. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. All right, Russell, go ahead.
What you do when you're over-vaccinating, giving multiple vaccinations at one time or over a short period of time, is that you won't allow the brain's immune system to shut down. And that just continues this free radical damage and lipid peroxidation damage in the brain and produces overall brain inflammation. This is why children scream and cry sometimes when they get vaccination, particularly little babies. In fact, they created a special name for it, that the babies are just uncontrollable. Mothers generally think it's because the site of the vaccination hurts, but it's not. It's a brain inflammation effect. And that's why these babies have this high-pitched crying. And we know that that inflammation is doing a considerable amount of damage in these small children because the brain after birth is undergoing rapid formation for the next 2 years. So from birth to age two, a child's brain is doing a lot of forming all the different pathways in the brain and arranging all the cells in the brain so that it can be properly formed for the future. This has particularly a lot to do with the ability of the child to learn, with its language functions and behavioral control. When we see this over vaccination syndrome, what it looks like is autism. Now, the second thing that bothers me about vaccines is that they add very powerful adjuvants. And the purpose of these adjuvants is to make the immune reaction very intense. Because if you just take, say, a virus that you want to stop, for instance, chickenpox, and you just make a vaccine a dead chickenpox virus and you inject it in somebody, you get a very weak immune reaction, if any reaction. So they add these chemicals in there to make your immune system react very intensely. Usually they use things like special fats. They'll use some proteins. Sometimes they'll use MSG. And they use mainly aluminum and mercury. Both of these are powerful immune adjuvants. So what they've discovered is that particularly with aluminum, it produces an immune reaction that goes on for years, an intense immune reaction. Well, that's abnormal. That's like being sick for a year or more. And the brain is inflamed for a year or more after that. And they're beginning to discover, and over 200 cases have been reported in France alone, and they're beginning to pick these cases up in the United States, is that after vaccination with these aluminum-containing vaccines, they develop this particular syndrome. They call it macrophagic myofasciitis.
Hold that thought there for just a moment. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. Russ Blaylock, and he was just saying that a lot of our children, when they have multiple vaccines, why they will tend to get inflammation of their brains that will last for a good period of time, and this is the reason why the children scream so often, sometimes after they've had their vaccinations, because they are getting swelling of their brains. And then they put the adjuvants in there, and they have an aluminum and mercury, and this will create a tremendous immune response. Of course, it's put in to create an immune response, but the immune response will continue in the body, and it will continue on in the brain. And they're finding out over in France, and even here now in the United States, the disastrous effect of this accentuated or this forced immune response on the child. So pick up the story there, Russell.
Yeah, they've named this the macrophagic myofasciitis syndrome, and it's characterized by intense muscle pain, weakness, intense fatigue, joint pains, and difficulty thinking, clouded thinking. And about 20% of these people develop what appears to be full-blown multiple sclerosis. Two vaccines it's most commonly associated with is the hepatitis B vaccine and the tetanus toxoid vaccine. These both have aluminum adjuvants in it. Most of your vaccines have aluminum adjuvants in it. And we're beginning to appreciate that aluminum is an extremely powerful brain toxin, and it accumulates in the brain. And the idea of giving children 33 injections of aluminum is just absolutely insane. It's difficult to believe that you would purposely do that.
Well, my understanding is that there have been studies that have shown that the nurses who took the hepatitis B vaccine, their incidence of multiple sclerosis increased 300%. Is that possible?
That's right. That was reported in the journal Neurology just recently. And it's a very careful study. No one's contested this study. But what it demonstrated was that within 3 years of your hepatitis B vaccine, there's a 300% increase incidence of multiple sclerosis. Now, that's a tremendous increase in the risk of you developing multiple sclerosis to combat a disease that very rarely causes any chronic problems. Most people who have hepatitis B either never know they were infected and completely recover, or they have a very mild disease and recover completely. It's only a very small percentage that develop what we call chronic active hepatitis.
About 15%, I think, something like that.
Right. And usually you can control people that have the chronic active hepatitis with some simple nutritional treatments. But they're scaring people by saying, oh, 300,000 people a year die from hepatitis B in this country. What the truth is that almost all those people are IV drug users, they're AIDS-infected people, they're people who had blood transfusions from people who had the infection. So the average person, the risk of hepatitis B is infinitesimally small, particularly children. There's no risk at all of a small baby born to a parent that's not involved in one of these risk groups. So the idea of vaccinating every child in the United States at birth with hepatitis B was absolutely insane, because there had never been a study to show it was safe. After they began the program, they looked at the immune system of a newborn and how it reacted to this vaccine, and found that because the immune system was not properly developed at that age, there was an abnormal immune reaction, and that this could produce immunological disorders in that child for the rest of its life. But the public was never told this.
And, of course, they are still giving it there in the nursery.
Right. And, you know, in the hurricane here in New Orleans, they're giving out hepatitis B vaccine to all the rescue workers and everybody who's in the area. Well, if 300% increase in multiple sclerosis in 3 years, that means a heck of a lot of those rescue workers, National Guardsmen, and people living in that area are going to have multiple sclerosis within 3 years. And it doesn't seem to be any concern. The same thing with the tetanus toxoid vaccine. This is associated with the French syndrome of the macrophagic myofasciitis. And as I said, 20% of those people are developing multiple sclerosis. So you're giving them two vaccines that have a very high incidence of producing multiple sclerosis. And this just doesn't make sense. I mean, to trade a very small risk of developing chronic active hepatitis for a devastating, life-shortening disease like multiple sclerosis is absolutely insane.
Well, there's so many things that are going on in the world today that are insane, but it almost as if this is a massive experiment on the children here, and so many parents don't really understand the implications of what's going to happen. They've got a newborn child, they're so happy, and they're giving them this very, very dangerous vaccine. I think it's one of the most dangerous vaccines that's given in the... certainly in the nursery, and of course until recently, until a couple of years ago, it had I think 85 times the dose of thimerosal of mercury in it that was allowed according to weight by the EPA.
Yes, that's right. It was 87-fold.
87-fold. I'm sorry.
This is reported. That's close enough. That was recorded. Reported in a legal investigation of the Merck Pharmaceutical Company. The senior scientist had sent a memo to his superior saying, I've tallied it up, and we're giving children 87 times higher dose of mercury than the EPA says is safe for an adult.
That was Dr. Hilleman, I believe, from
right.
Merck Company, right? I think he was an honest man.
And exactly right, and nothing happened, and then so now children are getting well over 100 times the dose. So not only did they take no action at the time of his memo, but they increased the number of vaccines given that contained this mercury compound. So children were getting a very, very high toxic dose of mercury, And the thing we know about mercury, ironically, is that mercury is one of the few metals that can activate the brain's immune system at very low concentrations. It doesn't take a very high concentration at all. In fact, it's less than is known to damage cells themselves. And it does this also by activating what we call the excitotoxic mechanism. That's the accumulation of glutamate in the brain. When we look at autistic children, they all have elevated glutamic acid in their spinal fluid. So we know that this is something commonly found, and that mercury will do that. It'll elevate the glutamic acid, which destroys brain connections and synapses and dendrites and eventually cells in the brain, and can cause, in these small children, the brain to be miswired. That is, the pathways and the connection, fiber connections in the brain are abnormal. We're dealing with something that is potentially irreversible in many of these children, if not caught early, and that is rather devastating in a lot of these children, because you get a spectrum of disorders. You can have either language disorders or behavioral disorders, ADD, ADHD, all the way up to full-blown autism with dementia. And loss of IQ as well as language and behavioral function. So these are quite serious things that are occurring, and we have very powerful evidence that it's due to the vaccine program. And unfortunately, our pediatricians are in the dark. They're not aware of this. They're trusting their medical societies.
And, of course, their medical societies, for one reason or another, seem to do everything they can to block the doctors from really getting the truth about the dangers of vaccinations. I know, when I practiced medicine, I had never heard any of these things, and yet this information's been around for quite some time, hasn't it?
Yes, and in fact, until I got to looking into it myself, I was just like every other physician. I wasn't aware of these things either. But once you start looking at the medical literature and reading the studies yourself, it becomes obvious that there's a large amount of studies, numerous studies that have been done to prove that this process of over-vaccination is extremely dangerous. The problem is the organization like the American Academy of Pediatrics, their vaccine board, when they were investigated, found that a significant percentage of the doctors serving on the vaccine board were receiving financial monies from the vaccine companies themselves. So they had a vested interest in putting out these vaccine policies to their member physicians. And the poor pediatrician, he received this information from his academy and believed it and thought it was true. And he's very busy and didn't take the time to look these things up. So he's carrying out a policy that's is damaging these children in huge numbers.
And I think that the average physician would be horrified to think that he would hurt a child, and I don't think the average physician would want to do that. And then when, of course, the parent comes back in and says, my child was fine until they got the vaccine shot that you gave them, and the doctor is extremely defensive and assures the parent there's nothing to worry about. Why, this was just coincidence. It could have happened, these things happen all the time. And just because, something happens after you give a shot doesn't mean there's any relations to it. And yet time after time, I've heard this story from so many parents, and there's no question. And now there are the scientific studies to show that these are damaging, and yet the average physician has no idea. And that's why I do the programs like this, and I'll put you in touch with Dr. Blaylock. He has the scientific studies, and he has a great newsletter. In fact, he's got one of those newsletters deals specifically with vaccines, and perhaps later on we can tell you how you can call and get copies of the newsletter. It's so important that you have the information, because, of course, the responsibility for yourself and for your children and your family is yours. You can't put this off on somebody else, especially when the doctors of this country are going to be getting information from their medical journals, which are financed by the drug companies, from their medical societies, where many of the people there in key positions are receiving sizable stipends from the people who are profiting from these injections. Well, Dr. Stan back here, I guess, this evening, Dr. Russell Blaylock. Russell, go ahead, pick up the story from there.
Looking back at these vaccine studies, one of the things that they use to terrify the mothers into getting their children vaccinated, they say, well, if you decide not to have your child vaccinated, you're endangering the rest of the community and the other children in this community, because what protects our community is what's known as herd immunity. And this is based on the idea that if you immunize 85% of the children in a community, then epidemic diseases cannot spread through the community. And it gives the whole community protection, and that's the whole idea of the herd immunity. Well, unfortunately, that's all based on a fallacy. Most of us have had diphtheria shots. We assume that we had lifelong protection from our vaccination, but the studies have shown that really it didn't last more than a couple of years. So we spent most of our lives totally unprotected. Most communities are totally unprotected against diphtheria unless you've had your shot in the last couple of years. So there's no herd immunity against diphtheria, yet we're not seeing epidemics of diphtheria. Most years there's zero cases, occasionally one or two cases, and those are usually immigrants from other countries. Same thing goes with pertussis and measles and mumps and rubella and all these other vaccinations that people are getting. We're beginning to find out that actually the immunization success of these vaccines is very low. At best, it's 50 or 60%. Nowhere near the 85% that's necessary for this mystical herd immunity. And then we find that the vaccines don't last more than 1 or 2 years. Well, when this was reported in the medical literature, their answer was, well, what we need to do is start giving boosters every couple of years. And they tried a test program and found out, well, actually, the booster didn't last a year. So they're having great difficulty. Well, their answer is to make these immune adjuvants or stimulants even more powerful. So they're looking for more and more powerful immune stimulants to up that from 50% immunization success to 85 or 90%. Unfortunately, when you add these very powerful immune stimulants, you're also increasing the risk of complications dramatically, things like multiple sclerosis, arthritis, and muscle pains, and the autism and the other neurological problems. There's virtually no consideration for that whatsoever. They're totally ignoring that connection. One of the dangerous adjuvants that they're considering is squalene. Squalene is known to produce a plethora of severe neurological problems, this is what was thought to be in the vaccine A, the anthrax vaccine that was causing all the problems in the Gulf War veterans, that they had secretly used squalene adjuvant, and that this was producing such an intense immune reaction, you were getting the neurological problems as well as the joint and pains and muscle pains and weakness that go along with it. And these things have all been proven in the scientific literature. It's not something that's secret. It's right there for anyone to examine.
Hold that thought, right? Be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, Dr. Russell Blaylock, and Dr. Blaylock was simply saying you hear a lot about herd immunity. You know, if you have 85% of the people immunized, why, then if you have herd immunity and the chances of an epidemic breaking out, pretty slim. But the problem is that most vaccines don't last for more than a year or two as far as good immunity is concerned. And even at best, why, only 50% of the people will get, you know, sufficient immunity. So now they want to add more adjuvants, these things to boost the immune system. They're talking about using squalene. Well, they used squalene experimentally on our boys in the Gulf War, and 50% of them, you're talking almost 300,000, somewhere there, 350,000 of the 695,000 young men who went over to the Gulf to fight, and they came home, or many of them came home quite healthy, and of course almost half of them are disabled today. And they have checked those at Tulane University, found that of the people who were ill, 95% of them had antibodies to squalene. The government says, we didn't do it, we didn't put it in. The FDA checked the samples of the vaccine that was given, and they found, of all things, squalene in it. That's covered in a book called Vaccine A. We have a four-tape set on that's an incredible story, and I know you're well acquainted with that, aren't you, Russell?
Yeah, it's an excellent book. Everybody should read that, because one of the points he makes is not only did they not learn the lesson of this terrible damaging effect of squalene in vaccines, but now they're wanting to put it in the flu vaccine, and other common vaccines are being given. So there was no halt on the use of squalene.
But, of course, this was known in Europe a long time ago. The studies over there showed the disastrous effect, producing autoimmune disease and chronic disability in a large percentage of the people who did it. And despite the fact it was in the medical literature, they experimented on the boys we sent to the first Gulf War, and almost half of them are disabled.
Ironically, it was the physician who knew the most about squalene complications who was responsible for putting it in the vaccine, according to the book Vaccine A, which is incredible. He had written most of the papers on the severe neurological complications associated with squalene adjuvant. Yet it was his recommendation that they use it in the vaccine itself.
And you have to ask yourself, why would anybody do something like that unintentionally? And you know, the thing that bothers me, Russell, is that since, you know, we started giving large numbers of vaccines to the American children, why one in six children has a neurodevelopmental or behavioral abnormality, according to the CDC. One in six children has asthma, which is a reflection of response to something has made them allergic. Never was like this before. Doesn't happen in other areas, other parts of the world where we're not vaccinating all the children. Certainly there's been a dramatic increase in autoimmune disease, a dramatic increase in juvenile diabetes in our children, and children who come to this country from other nations are quite healthy. They come here, they get their vaccines, and start eating the food and doing the other things the kids are doing here, and these kids are getting ill. I mean, that should be certainly a wake-up call, and yet the government says, we don't know why these things are happening, but we can assure it's not the vaccines.
You know, what you find is there's a lot of conferences that are going on among the virologists, the experts in the immune function. That's reported in the medical literature, but never surfaced to the general public. For instance, there's a lot of concern now that this over-vaccination is destroying the immune system of our youth, that they're receiving so many vaccines that their immune system becomes exhausted and doesn't function properly. This has been brought up in several international conferences on vaccination and immunology. Yet the public is unaware of it. The physicians that are giving the vaccines are unaware of it because they don't, take the time to look in the medical literature. But it's right there.
I understand even the veterinarians are getting concerned about over-vaccination of the animals.
In fact, the veterinarians seem to be ahead of the physicians. They're expressing a lot of concerns about these vaccines because they're seeing it in the animals. It's producing the same effect. They're seeing neurological effects, MS-like syndromes. They're seeing the joint pains, the muscle weakness. All the things we're seeing in people, they're seeing in their animals.
And so there is certainly a move within some of the veterinarians to cut back on excessive vaccines. Some of them they're going to give, but I think some of them they're certainly going to try to get away from. But, you know, if we're going to protect the animals and not give them too many vaccines, shouldn't we consider doing the same thing with our children? And when the government says, well, we have no idea why the one in every 166 children now has autism, whereas it used to be one in 10,000, but you can trust us, it's not the vaccinations. We have no idea why one in six children has asthma. We have no idea why the incidence of diabetes is increasing, but we can assure you it's not the vaccinations. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, our guest this evening, Dr. Russell Blaylock. Russell, go ahead, pick up the story there.
One of the things that's connected to immune suppression is the injection of the measles virus. All virologists know that the measles virus is a powerful immune-suppressing virus. And this is discussed in a lot of the literature on viruses. It acts much like the AIDS virus. It's a very significant inhibitor of immune function. One of the other things that was found out about the measles virus, you realize when your children's injected with the MMR vaccine, the measles part of it is a live virus, and they discovered by looking at autopsy brains of elderly people that 20% of people have live measles virus in their brain and 45% have live measles virus in other organs of the body. And to their surprise, these measles viruses were highly mutated. And what they suspect was that the virus sits in the body throughout their life, and that the natural production of free radicals damages the DNA of the virus, changing the virus from a harmless virus into a very powerful pathogenic virus, producing a number of diseases. Diseases that are not related to the usual measles-type symptoms. For instance, Crohn's disease, you see a high titer of measles virus in the intestine. They found measles virus in several of the neurological diseases. So this is something of great concern when you start injecting children, particularly small children with poorly functioning immune systems, with live viruses. These viruses remain in their body for the rest of their life, and they can mutate and produce a whole variety of new diseases, as well as suppress their immune system. So, that's why I would be very concerned about a child getting an MMR vaccine. I would discourage it. I wouldn't want my children to get it, and I certainly don't want my grandchildren to get the MMR vaccine. The other thing is that when you inject viruses into the tissues of the arm or the buttocks of a child or a leg, they're discovering that the immune reaction is not like when they're naturally exposed to these diseases. When I was a child and when you were a child, Stan, we didn't have these vaccines, and all of us got measles and mumps and chicken pox and all these diseases, what we call just childhood diseases.
Hold that thought there. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, Dr. Blaylock is just saying that they're finding now that these measles viruses get into the child with the immunization shots, and those measles viruses are with us for the rest of our lives, with the children for the rest of their lives. And, of course, you're finding this in Crohn's disease and certain neurological diseases, because although it's certainly an attenuated virus that they inject, where the virus can then begin to change living in the body and become a much more pathological and produce diseases that are not in any way related to measles. So what we've done, we've artificially created new diseases by injecting the live viruses into children, and furthermore the immune response you get from the injected virus is entirely different than the immune response that we got when we were young, Russell and I. And we got the measles. I got the measles, and I got the mumps, and I got the chicken pox. I got all those diseases. And you develop an immunity, and you're immune to them the rest of your life because it's a normal immunity. But the question is, what sort of immunity do these people get that get it injected into their arms? And by altering the means of introducing the virus into the individual, well, what happens, Russell?
Well, what you find is that because it bypasses the mucous membrane, where most viruses naturally enter your body, you have an abnormal immune reaction, and so that it's not a lifelong immunity any longer. It lasts for a year, a couple of years, and then it disappears. So that's why those of us who had natural infections as children have lifelong immunity, and people who get the vaccinations don't. And this is what's turning up time and again when we see outbreaks of measles or mumps or these other diseases. Almost all the cases are in children who were vaccinated either partially or fully vaccinated. It's not in the children who are not vaccinated that you're seeing these diseases. And we also know that it tends to protect the whole community when you have these childhood viruses that circulate, because it keeps everybody's immunity at a higher level. But once you start this vaccination process, you lose that protection. These things are all known, and one of the things that's really becoming of concern is this widespread use of the chickenpox vaccine. Is this going to cause herpes zoster? And there's evidence that, in fact, the number of cases of herpes zosters in adults is going up since they started the chickenpox vaccination program.
And that's the shingles, of course, and we all got chickenpox, and, you know, when we were children, and you got over it in a couple of days, and many people then will carry the virus with them all the rest of their lives when they get very old. Why, they'll develop what they call shingles, which is basically a manifestation of chickenpox involving the nerves coming out of the spinal column, and you'll see this pattern of vesicles, a little sort of blister-like things following the pattern of a nerve, but it's very painful. But you say that there actually seem to be getting more of the zoster, the shingles, in the people who've had the artificial immunity?
Right, because when the virus is occurring in the children as a natural childhood disease and the adults are exposed to it, it boosts their immunity back up again through a natural process. So it keeps their immunity against the chickenpox virus constantly up to date. That suppresses the virus so that they don't get the shingles. But since the children have this artificial injected virus, the adults are no longer getting this re-stimulation, and so they're seeing a lot more cases of shingles than they ever did before. Also, we know that the adult's nutrition begins to fall, and that causes a drop in their immune status as they reach about age 50. They can get rather severe immune suppression, and that activates the virus. So all these live viruses that are being injected in you as you reach age 50, if you're not following good nutritional program, your immune system is going to be significantly suppressed, and you're going to develop a lot of complications. This is one of the problems with the flu vaccine. This is one of the best-kept secrets among the vaccine experts, is that it's almost impossible to vaccinate the elderly against flu. It just doesn't work, and that's because their immune system is so poorly functioning at that age that they won't develop immunity. And so now there are new hypotheses as well. What we should do is vaccinate the group of people that they're getting the virus from, and that's mainly people from age 6 to 18. So there's a new program. Well, what we should do is make sure all of these young people are vaccinated with the flu vaccine. Now, the problem is the flu vaccine is not the proper virus most of the time, and they have a full dose of mercury in it. It has the full dose of thimerosal. So you would be injecting small children, for the next 10 years or so with a dose of mercury every year. And this is a very vulnerable period of their life.
Well, of course, you had actually, we talked in the past about Dr. Fudenberg's work, but would you want to mention to our listeners what has Dr. Fudenberg found in people between 60 and 65 who took 3 to 4 influenza shots over a 5-year period?
Yeah, what he discovered is that if they took this repeated flu shot during that period, there was a 1,000% increase in Alzheimer's disease, and that it was probably a combination of the mercury toxicity and the aluminum toxicity.
But, of course, if you're getting that dramatic a response increase in Alzheimer's disease in the elderly, what are you doing to the brains of our children at 6 months of age when you're giving them a similar vaccine?
Well, then you're going to produce a lifelong problem. You're injecting them with doses of mercury from a very young age, and you're just going to produce a disaster. And they also recommend all pregnant women have the flu vaccine. Now, this is absolute idiocy. A pregnant woman, particularly the last trimester of her pregnancy, that's the period of extremely rapid brain growth in the child. We know that the placenta actually concentrates the mercury so that the baby's dose is much higher than the mother's. And we also know that the baby's brain is infinitely more sensitive to that mercury than is the mother. So the toxic effect is much worse in the undeveloped baby than it is in the mother. Then after birth, here you come along getting another series of vaccines at age 6 months or at birth, again assaulting the brain with overstimulation of the immune system and the addition of mercury and aluminum to their brain. So, you know, it just does not make good scientific sense. We have abundant scientific evidence that it's very harmful to the brain of these children. And a pregnant woman, it's harmful to her brain as well. Then to continue this flu vaccine all the way up to age 18 is just absolute insanity.
And, of course, the thimerosal is mercury. Mercury is so toxic. Why we're so worried about it in the water, we're worried about it in the air, we're worried about it in the tuna fish, but we're injecting it into six-month-old children. In fact, until recently, when so many parents made such a fuss, why they were putting it in all or so many of the childhood vaccines, a number of them. But you don't have to worry. We've taken out of the childhood vaccines, at least most of the childhood vaccines, but not all of them. But we're giving it to children all throughout the rest of the world and all the underdeveloped countries where we have our vaccine programs, because we're so magnanimous in America. We want to help these children. We're destroying their minds. Why would you do something like that unintentionally?
Well, we've also discovered that the vaccine companies have repeatedly lied. 1999 is when they first agreed to remove thimerosal from the vaccine. In the year 2001, if you looked in the physician's desk reference, you found out that it still contained a full dose of mercury. By year 2002, they said, well, that was just old stocks that we were using up. Now there's no mercury in the vaccines. Well, when the vaccines were checked in 2003, the thimerosal was still there. They say, well, again, the same excuse, well, we were just using up old stocks of vaccine. The evidence indicated that, well, they would have used up those stocks long ago, that obviously they're putting more thimerosal in the vaccines. Now, the interesting thing is the FDA just asked them to do it. There's no program to check and see if they're actually removing the mercury. They're just trusted to have done it. And they've demonstrated by what I've said that they're not trustworthy.
Now, we've certainly seen that with Merck, and they're putting the Vioxx on the market when they knew it. Their initial study showed not doubling of the incidence of heart attack and stroke, but sevenfold increase in the initial study, which they never published, and they certainly never let the doctors know that a sevenfold increase in the initial study, I think a 5% increase in the second study. Dramatic increase, sevenfold, fivefold, threefold increase in the incidence of heart attack. Can we really trust the companies that would do that to our adults with the lives of our children? Russell, before I forget, do you have the telephone number for people to call where they can get learn more about getting your newsletter?
I don't have the telephone number, but I have the website.
Well, go ahead. Why don't you get that out? Because Russell puts out a newsletter. I take it. It is the finest newsletter. In fact, we just had one of our callers from Florida, regular listeners, who just called in and off the air and said that's the best newsletter he's ever seen. And I will tell you, I believe that. I take it. We read it. My wife reads it. And I think you'll find it fascinating. How can people learn more about your newsletter?
They can get on www.blaylockreport.com.
Okay, that's www.blaylockreport.com. Is that right?
That's right.
All right, fine. And let me recommend that to you. I think that you'll find that it will give you insight and not only into vaccines, but to so many things having to do with your health. And remember, you don't really get a second time around. You know, if you do the wrong things and your body, your heart, your mind are destroyed. And we have really skyrocketing incidence of Alzheimer's disease in America. And the officials at the Centers for Disease Control say, well, we have no idea what is happening, but we know it has nothing to do with this, that, or the other thing. Well, let's talk a little bit about maybe the Simpson-Wood study, because the Simpson-Wood report, I think that came out in the year 2000, it was marked top secret. It involved a number of people, experts in the field of thimerosal and vaccination, and representatives of the vaccine industry, but nobody from the general public was allowed to attend, and this was a government-financed meeting, but it was marked top secret. What was that all about, and why was it marked top secret and kept from the American people and the parents of the children who've been damaged by autism?
Well, this special conference was held in Norcross, Georgia, and ironically it followed another conference on the toxicity of aluminum in vaccines, which was held a year before. But this conference included 51 scientists that they gathered and five vaccine companies. And the ironic thing I found about the conference was that everyone had comments about the study, but not a single comment from any of the vaccine companies. They just sat silently and listened. But basically what this entailed was they were looking at data that had been collected by the Center for Disease Control on vaccine safety. The Center for Disease Control collects data on complications due to vaccination, and they've collected this for years, but no one ever looked at any of this data, just sat there unexamined. It's called a vaccine safety data link. Now, Dr. Thomas Verstraeten and his group got together and took the data and examined it to see if there was any connection between vaccinating children and the neurodevelopmental problems in children, such as autism. And what they discovered with a very careful analysis of this, and it was very intentionally done, was that there was a 248% increased risk of neurodevelopmental disorders in children exposed to mercury. What made this discovery so incredible was that they used the dose of mercury in children, the control children, that is children that were supposed to be the lowest level, really had a fairly high dose of mercury. So they didn't even use or compare children that had no exposure to vaccines containing mercury. Even though they did have access to it, they didn't use them. And so they took the lowest dose and called it a control, and then they used higher doses after that. And what they found is the higher the dose of mercury in the vaccine, the worse the problem in these children's brain development, and that it affected their behavior, their learning ability, and particularly their language function, their ability to speak and use language, and that it was statistically significant. And all of the people attending the conference, the 51 scientists, they went through each one of them one at a time. They all agreed that this was statistically significant. It was a significant finding that deserved further investigation. So no one found any flaws, and they picked this study apart, over half the reports, just picking this apart to see if there's any weak points, and they couldn't find any. So they agreed that this was a significant finding. Now, at the end of the conference, you would think, well, they all agreed that this is a significant finding, that there's this tremendous increase in neurodevelopmental problems in children exposed to mercury-containing vaccines, and that the more vaccines they got, the higher the incidence and the worse the severity of the damage. You would think they would announce this to the media. The media would tell the public, we found a major problem here in this conference. there was absolute silence. The paper, the minutes of the meeting were marked confidential, not to be released. It was to be guarded. And their fear was that if this got out, the public would be shocked. They wouldn't want to take the vaccines or have their children exposed, and it would ruin the vaccine program. And so rather than do that, they just covered it up for the next 4 years. After 4 years, they finally, it was published in the journal Pediatrics, but it had been severely altered, so that the new report that appeared for the public to read and the media said that they didn't find any connection between the mercury in the vaccine and neurodevelopmental problems in children.
But by that time, Dr. Verstraeten had gone to work for the a very drug company that was creating the vaccines that were creating all the problems. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Russell Blaylock. And, of course, would the vaccine company hire somebody to silence them? Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Dr. Russell Blaylock. We're talking about the Simpsonwood study done back in the year 2000, where everybody at the meeting agreed that there was a real problem with the mercury in the vaccines. When the study was reported in the Journal of Pediatrics some 3 or 4 years later, why by that time, Dr. Verstraeten, although he said he was working for the CDC, which would suggest he was impartial, and he was, was reporting the truth. But the trouble is, now, why suddenly the findings were entirely different? Is it because Dr. Verstraeten at that time had moved to Europe and was now working for GlaxoSmithKline that makes the vaccines and was doing all the harm? Of course, they said why we would never hire him just to get him to change the results of his study, and Dr. Verstraeten said why I would never change the results of my study just because I was working for the people that were doing all the harm. All we can do is just suggest that if this isn't, these people are of integrity, why did they conceal the fact that Dr. Verstraeten was now working for GlaxoSmithKline, the vaccine manufacturer that was harming so many children? I mean, he actually lied, deceived when he wrote that article, didn't he, saying he was working for the CDC?
That's exactly right. And at the time that he had, I think, resigned from the CDC 2 years before, so he'd been working for GlaxoSmithKline, and the GlaxoSmithKline company had multiple lawsuits filed against him over thimerosal toxicity.
And
he had a vested interest.
Of all the people in the world, why would they hire the one man who had the statistics that would incriminate them, and that, of course, then would cost them billions of dollars? Why would they hire that one man who, of course, had come up with the incriminating evidence?
Exactly right. I mean, they were closing that loophole so that they could control this information. So this was a powerful study. This was the stake in the heart. I mean, here we found this carefully researched, highly statistically significant study that said the more vaccines these children get, the more likely they're going to have severe developmental brain problems. And the greater the severity of these problems. But that wasn't the end of it. Dr. Geyer and Mark and David Geyer asked to look at the data from the Centers for Disease Control, which is called the VAERS, V-A-E-R-S, which is a Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting Database. This is an even more accurate database held by the CDC, and they wanted to use this.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Russell. We got to just bring our stations back on board, and then we'll wrap this up. All right, Russell, why don't you tell the rest of the story?
And so they were going to use this database, this very accurate database, to look at the question from a fresh view. The CDC refused to let them look at it. And so it ended up they had to use congressional pressure, and finally it was released. So they did the study and looked at it, and what they found was a 600% increase in autism and a 610% risk of retardation, a 220% increased risk of speech disorders, and a 60% increased risk of seizures in children that were receiving these vaccines containing thimerosal with mercury. It even surprised them. They were totally surprised by this. They published their results and gave all of the information and asked any other researchers who wanted to look at it to look at it, and if they found criticisms, they welcomed them. Well, no one came forward with any criticisms. It was a very carefully done study. It proved beyond a shadow of doubt from the CDC's own database that vaccines contain thimerosal damage the brains of children, and it can produce problems in behavior, speech development, and learning that can be permanent.
Well, Russell, I wish we could go on, but unfortunately we're out of time. I want to thank you so very much for being with us, and I'm just so glad that you and your family are safe. I know it's a terrible thing for your son to have lost his home, but, you know, at least he's safe, and, you know, all the relatives are safe. So thank you so much for being with us, Roy. I know that you just got back from the trip. Things are pretty stressful back there, but thank you for sharing this information with our audience tonight.
Well, thank you, Stan. God bless you.
And you too. Bye-bye. Good night.
Bye.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Russell Blaylock, and certainly his book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. His book, Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills. His book, Natural Strategies for Health for Cancer Patients. And of course, his newsletter, great sources of information. If you'd like, to get in touch with my ministry, it's www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. We do have a newsletter where we go into the background of vaccinations, and if you'd like to get a copy of that, you can call us and simply ask for a free copy of my newsletter on vaccination. We'd be glad to send it to you. And you need to understand that the death from childhood diseases has fallen dramatically before the vaccines were ever introduced. And it was because of the increasing health of our children. The trouble was that since they've been getting the vaccines, they've been developing all sorts of other diseases. Devastating diseases that are destroying the brains and the minds and the future of our children. And one out of every six American children has either a neurodevelopmental or behavioral abnormality. One out of every six American children has asthma. You don't find that among the Amish because they won't vaccinate their children. Maybe those people who drive the horses and buggies are a lot smarter than some of us who have all these degrees in education. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the time we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our website, RadioLiberty.com. And until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. It was Winston Churchill who said, "Still, if you will not fight for the right when you can easily win without bloodshed, if you will not fight for the right when your victory will be sure and not too costly, you may come to the moment when you'll have to fight with all odds against you and only a perilous chance for survival. Or there may be a worse case. There may come a time when you'll have to fight with no hope for victory, for it would be better to perish than to live as slaves." Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are involved in a spiritual battle for the survival of Western civilization. Our battle is the truth. Our battle is the sword of the Lord, the Scriptures. So pray for America.